Good morning and welcome to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Earlier this morning, you might have heard a story on hemp by our friends at Harvest Public Media. On Central Standard this morning, inspired by that story, we're going to talk about how the most recent farm bill could shift the conversation about hemp, both nationally and regionally. Let's start by saying good morning to Doug Fine, a sustainability writer, who authored Hemp Bound, a work of first-person journalism that has earned passionate endorsements from lots of people, including Willie Nelson. Hi, Doug. How are you this morning?
Hey, Gina. Great to be with you.
Well, could you lay out what this provision in the Farm Bill is all about, maybe clarifying for us what it does and doesn't allow with respect to hemp cultivation?
Sure. The specifics of the hemp provision that was in this year's Farm Bill that Congress passed and the president signed on February 7th, allow for university-connected research of hemp in states that have hemp legislation, which just went up to 15 yesterday with South Carolina joining the team. And it's important because we've lost the genetics of what was once the best hemp seed and also a very important industry in the heartland in Kansas and Missouri. So the hemp research is important, but even more important than the specifics of what happened in the Farm Bill, it was a major, major policy shift after 77 years of hemp prohibition.
You said joining the team. So do you perceive yourself to be on a team?
I perceive humanity to be on the hemp team. And I say this as a journalist of 2 decades experience. Folks can Google me. Very legitimate, and yet, as a father, I pay a lot of attention to climate change and sustainability issues. And in researching hemp, let's put it this way, Gina, the hardest part for me about discussing hemp is not sounding like your roommate with the lava lamp, but explaining that your roommate with the lava lamp was right about a lot of hemp's qualities, and here's the research to prove it. Energy is the really big one I'm excited about. I think farm biomass from American Heartland Hemp Farms is going to help us wean us from fossil fuels.
All right. Well, you mentioned, we'll get back to a lot of those uses, but you mentioned that this represents a policy shift. Could you describe that in a little more detail?
Sure. So in 1937, the Marijuana Tax Act passed, and it sort of wiped hemp away along with all versions of the cannabis plant. That prohibition didn't go very well. Right from the beginning, the drug war was exporting jobs offshore because the Navy needed 40 tons of hemp rigging for every vessel, and we were now getting it from the Philippines. But the Japanese captured the Philippines. So in 1942, there was this fantastic propaganda film that the USDA put out that sounded like your roommate with the lava lamp, pleading for farmers to grow hemp for the war effort. And in fact, George Bush Sr.'s parachute harness that saved his life in his action was made with hemp. So you'd think that we'd be sort of aware of the plant's potential and thankful for it. But no, this prohibition actually continued basically through bureaucratic inertia until this past February. So it has been effectively illegal to grow this very, very useful plant for 77 years.
Well, Doug, we actually have a clip from Hemp for Victory, the film that you just referenced that was produced in 1942 to encourage American farmers to grow hemp. And it is disorienting to hear this 1940s narrator voice teaching American farmers how to do it, what to do. We're going to play a short clip from that film for our listeners, and then we'll get right back to you, okay?
Great.
In 1942, 14,000 acres of fiber hemp were harvested in the United States. The goal for 1943 is 300,000 acres. Thus, hemp, Cannabis sativa, the old standby cordage fiber, is staging a strong comeback. This is Kentucky hemp going into the dryer of a mill at Versailles.
So, Doug, how did we go from that kind of patriotic love of hemp cultivation to the scenario we have today with this crop, really, for many people, being associated with debauchery and bad behavior?
I have to say, Gina, I've been reporting on drug policy now for full time for about 5 years, and looking for logic or a sensible reason behind specifically the war on cannabis, even from a public safety standpoint for any uses of the plant, is an exercise in futility. There is no logic behind it. However, journalistically, I really do believe that in hemp's case, and hemp is defined the world over as any variety of the cannabis plant with 0.3% of THC or less.
And THC, just in case people don't know, that is?
One of the active ingredients in cannabis known as a cannabinoid. And so its absence means that the plant is just vegetative like any other, like a tomato or broccoli. No psychoactivity at all. Canada has a 15-year-old modern industry that's going to broach $1 billion this year. And there's never, ever been a case of confusion between psychoactive cannabis and hemp. But I believe that we actually, there is an upside of hemp prohibition.
And that
is, if you look this, well, what I just did for the last 2 years is look at the hemp industry worldwide. And I don't think anyone's done that before. And the reason why, what I came away with is the hemp industry is very geographically distinct. The Canadians are growing almost only for seed oil. It's very, very profitable crop, as American farmers realize. They're salivating. Europeans kind of tend to do the high-end textile stuff, fibers that are in BMW and Mercedes door panels, for instance, and they're leading the hempcrete construction revolution. It's a construction material made from hemp that's very sustainable and better R value or insulation than pink fiberless. And China does almost exclusively, not almost exclusively, but they lead the world in textiles, of which I wear a lot. Hemp is something I'm clothed in almost all the time, even my kids with their diapers, because it wins in the marketplace. So what I'm trying to preach, we talked about whether or not we're members of this hemp team here, is that American farmers in their Generation 1 facilities can use that knowledge of what's going on around the world to immediately start processing for what's most profitable and also what's most needed. And that includes energy applications from the otherwise unusable biomass that's left at the end of all these other applications.
You mentioned the market for it. What is the market for it in the United States?
By far today, the biggest market for hemp, and the reason why the hemp revolution is real, in other words, the reason why the Farm Bill includes a hemp provision, the reason why we're having this conversation now, is not about hugging trees and wearing tie-dyes. It's very simple. Canadian farmers today make $300 per acre profit, and I know there's heartland farmers listening to this right now and probably pause to listen to jaws drop and you know, hit combines or whatever. $300 per acre from hemp seed oil. It's a nutritive superfood. I've researched it. It's not just a rumor. It's got an incredible omega fatty acid balance as well as high minerals like magnesium that it's especially hard for vegetarians and vegans to get, and also high in protein. So that's the market. It's growing 24% per year. The Canadian processors, also members of whom I interviewed, they can't keep up with the demand. They can't wait for American farmers to be growing this. And by comparison, many listeners will already know this, your GMO, if you're lucky, your GMO corn, soy, wheat cycle profit per acre, you're lucky if you're in the $30, $40, $50 an acre. So Canadians are making nearly 10 times that on a crop that actually is soil restorative.
Well, we're going to talk about all of this more in this show with you, Doug Fine, but let's also say hello to Mark Mayfield, who serves as director of Kansas State University's herbarium. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Gina.
Well, first of all, what is an herbarium?
Well, it's a collection of plants that has been gathered over sometimes several hundred years. In the case of European herbaria, and our herbarium started in the 1870s, and those plants, each sample has a tag that indicates where and when it was collected and by whom. And therefore, it provides us a record long-term of where plants are, essentially.
Do you have hemp in that collection?
Yes, we do.
Tell us a little bit about what you've observed studying it.
It seems that, somebody at some point probably purged the collections of all of our hemp, because most of the specimens are from recent times. And so it seems as though even though I know the plant was fairly well naturalized by the early part of the 20th century, naturalized meaning it occurred in ditches and whatnot in Kansas, and it's pretty well established now. So my students, when we have classes, they will notice it and they'll collect it and put it on a press and everything. And so we end up with several of these, but pretty much over the last 30 or 40 years. So I don't really have a good, what I'm saying is I don't have a good history using this herbarium on the actual patterns of colonization by the wild hemp. But you probably want to know more about where it came from and
I
so on.
I do, yes. How it ever got here in the first place.
Yeah. So I suspect, and there's some data to indicate this is probably the case, that people knew for a long time, have known for millennia, that it's a fantastic fiber plant, as Doug was talking about. And so they brought it with them, essentially. The pioneers would have had plenty of uses for it. The earliest, probably French people who settled anywhere, probably recognized its utility and therefore would have probably liked to have a little bit of that around to make what they were accustomed to their rope with, and or textiles for that matter. But as Doug was saying, I think the plant more used for utility, like rope, would be sort of the idea.
Well, since you are a scientist, I am curious about your perspective on this. The laws governing the cultivation of hemp are still tied up with that substance being on the controlled substances list, which...
Sure.
Which means essentially it's illegal. So even though the farm bill allows states to set up pilot programs growing it for research, it's
right.
More broadly still illegal to grow. It's confusing. So let's start by establishing the relationship between hemp and its psychoactive relatives like marijuana.
Okay. So the taxonomy that I have access to that was basically essentially revised in 1976 by two well-respected taxonomists from different areas of the field. One, a chemotaxonomist, someone who studied the chemicals, and another person who was more of a morphological or a person who looked at the plants to decide what the taxonomy was like, said they came to the same conclusion that there are two wild versions or subspecies, they called them, of cannabis sativa from Asia. And those two different wild sets of populations had more of the psychoactive elements and the other one had less of them. And so naturally the one with the more psychoactive elements was brought into cultivation for that reason, and the one with the with less, for some reason or another, also had better fiber properties. It was longer fibers, taller plants, etc. And so that one was brought into cultivation for the rope and the hemp.
In his book, Hemp Bound, Doug Fine, who's still with us, takes readers on a journey to meet what he calls hemppreneurs. That's people who are finding uses for hemp that might have a real market. So there's hempcrete, which can be used like concrete, and there's a hemp lime insulation for houses. There's hemp seed oil for nutrition, which you can put in a smoothie if you're the smoothie-making type. But as a scientist who studies plants, what's your take on the wide-ranging applications of hemp being touted by the plant's proponents? Is there a scientific basis that you can identify?
I am sure that there is probably some element of trying to market hemp as friendly with the public among those that would like to see less prohibition for the psychoactive uses. But on the other hand, there's no doubt that if we completely prohibit the use of hemp, we're missing out on a very potentially very useful crop, not only from the textile or rope or whatever fiber standpoint, but from the standpoint of being able to take advantage of its real medicinal properties. And so, whereas I'm not going to try to say that I know anything about the nutritive value of hemp, I don't doubt that those are there, because omega-3s are proven to be good, and if they're high, if the seeds are high in omega-3s, then by all means, we wouldn't hurt by having that in the market.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman, talking today with Doug Fine, author of Hemp Bound, and Mark Mayfield from Kansas State University's Herbarium. Doug Fine, let's get back to you. Tell us, I was just mentioning some of the, what you call hemppreneurs, both nationwide and, in fact, nationally, or internationally. Can you take us to some of the places where you've witnessed the industrial uses of hemp in person? I'd like to start in Asheville, North Carolina, if you don't mind.
Sure. I mean, a quick side note in that there's a guy named David Murley, who in the 1820s was a big Missouri hemppreneur, and he had this boom and bust story that I talk about a little bit in Hempbound, where he won and then lost a Navy contract and then tried this radical new way of processing hemp, but it killed too many of his workers and he went bust.
Killing a lot of people is problematic.
Yes. Yeah. He's not thought of as one of the hemp success stories, but it's a Missouri story. So I thought I had to.
When was that?
1820s.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. So now to Asheville.
Asheville. Right. So that, for whatever reason, there's a movement, a real hemp create, a real hemp building movement in North Carolina going on. It's like three different houses in Asheville. Talk about the New South. And these are important because I believe on the fiber side, construction is going to be the first killer app. The reason is, after visiting European facilities, people that have been at it for decades and studying the Chinese textiles industry, they're way ahead of us on this stuff. And if somebody's dream is to revitalize those closed South Carolina textile mills and get a hemp, fiber processing going on, that's really American made clothing. I would, just to cut the carbon miles out alone, as Peter Tosh says, I will advertise it. But, construction is pretty easy. You just chop up the fiber and mix it with lime, and it makes a very fast curing, easy to handle, non-toxic, and superior insulating material, superior to pink fiberglass insulation. And it's called hempcrete, sort of generically, and it's a kind of a rage in Europe, pretty fast-growing side of the market.
What distinguishes it from concrete?
So for one thing, it doesn't have to be heated to thousands of degrees on the work site. It doesn't have toxic components, so it's more carbon friendly even during the building site, during the building time. It's non-toxic. It's not off-gassing anything. Like today, there's issues with the materials that are actually in our homes, from drywalling to insulation, that they're actually bad for us. This is a biofiber that's actually good for you, which is one of the reasons that one of the people that built one of the Asheville houses did it, was because of chemical allergies, that kind of thing, environmental needs for a member of their family, that it actually really helped. It also sequesters carbon. It sounds like when you start to talk about all these materials of all these qualities of hemp, again, seasoned journalist, I have to take a couple of steps back and say, it doesn't sound so magical and peace signy when you think of it as Michael Pollan, the author, thinks of it, which is, we've basically bred golden retrievers to fetch stuff for us and be friendly to kids. And we're not, slapping our heads about it all day. It's what humans do when they want certain qualities in something. And we have coexisted with this plant for just about longer than any other plant. Just a Stanford-led team found a very well-preserved hemp clothing in a grave site in Anatolia, Turkey, here just a few years ago. So we're talking about, a long, long history of the plant. And Gina, if I could, without rambling too long, I was blown away by Mark's comment that there actually is hemp seed in the herbarium, and that's really like huge news, depending on when it's from. And Missouri right now is in the midst of a big effort to get this plant back, not in for the first time, but back in Missouri's soil. And the genetics of that seed might be important, because there's a debate going on in the early American hemp industry now. And the argument goes, as Mark was pointing out, that, you know, these pioneers in their, by the way, canvas or cannabis slash hemp covered wagons settling the wilds of Missouri were, you know, they had whatever seeds were in coffee cans with them. They threw it in the soil and managed to make a world leading industry out of it. So people are saying, let's do that. Let's let Darwin decide. And there's a role for that. But the Canadian industry is big business. And they accurately point out that if you're not going to just be selling Donna's special hemp seed shampoo at the farmer's market, that when you're playing with the big guys, you know, you have to be a grown up and cultivate it the way that every other plant is cultivated in our modern industry, for better or for worse, with approved cultivars and standardization, hairnet era, the whole deal.
So, why is it such a big deal that there is a seed available in Kansas? Is that what's the story with the seeds?
Well, for the most part, there was a brand name industry. There's a terrific photo that a hempster, Adam Eidinger, dug up in Washington, D.C. archives of a USDA researcher on land that's today the Pentagon, surrounded by these 12-foot-high stalks of hemp seed. And he was just doing research for American farmers, and there were all these cultivar names that were known that you could buy in your feed store, and that's almost all lost. There's kind of an adventure at the beginning of my book where a researcher goes in looking for it in Virginia at the National Seed Repository, and it's all just a couple of open bags and decayed. So to actually have something that was the real deal, potentially viable and on hand, if I was hearing Mark correctly, That's big news. And to one of
Why don't we ask him, Mark? Is that the case?
Yeah. So I would say I don't know anything about the longevity of these seeds. And you did say viable, right? And so I think that most seeds can persist in a soil bank for quite some time. But when you put them in a dry herbarium, depending on the species, they might last for. Some might last for 3 years, some might last for 1,000 years. You just never know. But nonetheless, I would also like to point out that most of these were collected in the last 30 to 50 years. And the same plants that those were collected from in terms of genetic stock should be still out there in the ditches, because I see them all the time.
That's funny. But so are you saying, though, that you don't know whether the seeds in the herbarium are viable?
And that, yes, correct. And the point of the herbarium is not to preserve seeds. There are such things as germplasm resource centers, which do preserve seeds in a special type of facility, temperature and all this, to preserve those long term. We have one here on campus for wheat. So, but for the herbarium, the purpose is more for the person like me that studies the distribution and the morphology of the plants. Now, that's not to say you couldn't go in and look for things that grow. I have done that for various plants that I'm interested in, but more from the standpoint of understanding what that plant that was collected at that spot looked like than from the standpoint of being able to grow it and make money off of it. I don't make a lot of money doing this, but nonetheless, that's kind of the idea. Well, we study what they look like as well as growers down to.
It sounds
so that
like
I
you
can
might have
tell you what it is, right?
Yeah. Well, it sounds like you might have captured some interest in Doug Fine here. Doug, talk a little bit more about the seed issue, because it's confusing from a legal standpoint that it's legal to sell products made with hemp, but that it is illegal to transport seeds across borders and to grow hemp.
Well, it's ripped from the headlines today. The state of Kentucky is embroiled in a lawsuit with the Drug Enforcement Administration in federal court as we speak. There was a hearing last Friday because the DEA has seized some seed that the state is officially, per the federal law in the Farm Bill, legally importing from Italy, viable hemp seed. And so, you know, everybody's doing their little Shakespearean bureaucratic role here, and I guess the DEA is you know, doing what they think they do. And so there's a lawsuit about even what this federal law said as of last February. Let's put it this way. There's a little bit of inertia after 77 years of prohibition. But let's take the long view. It's 9,000 years of interaction with the plant. And on Mark's point, on the seed issue, Mark raises this issue of ditchweed, which really can play a role, absolutely, because you never know if an Italian cultivar is going to work in Kentucky soil. And so for heartland farmers, let's say Missouri, Ohio, they're going to have to look around the world and find cultivars that are successful at similar altitudes, similar levels of humidity and amount of rainfall. And also early research is showing phytoperiod is very important, same length of day for successful cultivars. And perhaps that's going to involve taking an Uzbeki hemp fiber cultivar and crossbreeding it with a traditional ditchweed that's won out, in a Darwinian fashion in the ditches of Missouri. And that will create some terrific cultivar that allows a seed oil harvest and a fiber harvest and an energy harvest. So who knows? And on Mark's point of hempsters hyping the good side of hemp.
Hempsters, I like that.
Yeah, because they want to see it. Well, Thomas Jefferson was one advocating hemp cultivation and drafting the Declaration of Independence on hemp. My grandparents grew up in Hempstead, New York. So to the extent that people want hemp to succeed and they're enthusiastic about it, I read a report. I think it was a Purdue University study, some study that came out recently, saying that in fact it is the image of hemp as being associated with healthy living and progressive values, combined with the enthusiastic base of early supporters, that is one factor that the author believes is going to help hemp kind of launch into the zeitgeist beyond, 15 minutes of fame as a health craze, but rather something that really becomes part of the economy.
I want to jump in there because you write in your book about how most people in the early hemp industry, as you're calling it, are really careful to delineate that they're talking exclusively about hemp, which can't be used for the purposes of getting high, and other forms of cannabis that can be used that way. But one grower very openly and proudly proclaimed his love of all uses of cannabis, and you wrote that you had taken a mental note of this. So I want you to spell that out a little bit. What's your take on how to talk about these different but related plants? Can the messenger be as important as the message when it comes to hemp, given its reputation?
To be honest, I think the culture war surrounding hemp is over. When you have Mitch McConnell, the Senate Minority Leader, conservative Republican from Kentucky, suing the DEA to allow hemp to be imported into his state, I don't think we're really fighting the culture war. To be honest, why I took note of the fact that both David Bronner, the CEO of a $54 million and growing Dr. Bronner's Hemp and Olive Oil Soap Company, really interesting company, by the way. CEO takes five times the income of the lowest paid employee. Everything's fair traded, and the olive oil comes from a orchard jointly run by Israelis and Palestinians. Again, hemp's image, that's the brand right there. That and the fact that this CEO chained himself with a hemp plant in front of the White House in a cage last year and had to be chainsawed out. So the hemp brand is real, I think that indeed is where the profit lies.
Well, Central Standard is going to take a quick break, and when we get back, you'll have the chance to call in and ask questions of Mark Mayfield and Doug Fine, who are experts here talking with us about hemp cultivation, both nationally and regionally. The number to call is 816-235-2888, and we'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman, and today we're talking about hemp, its cultivation agriculturally, and the provision in the most recent farm bill that you can grow it, if your state permits it, for research purposes in pilot programs. So interpretation is a little bit unclear on that in some states, but here in Kansas and Missouri, that does not currently apply. But we're exploring what the history is of hemp in our region and what the possibilities are for hemp agriculturally on a national scale. With us are Mark Mayfield from Kansas State University and Doug Fine, author of Hemp Bound, a recent book that takes you on a journey among hemppreneurs and such. We'd love to hear from you at 816-235-2888. And we've already got some callers on the line, so why don't we go right to them? We've got Bill and Miriam. Hi, Bill.
Hello. Yes. I didn't even mean to listen to the program, but you got me thinking about things that I had read before. And I think the first one was that pollen counts back to the last ice age maybe show that hemp was a dominant, well, anyway, a major plant in this area, probably in Missouri also. And so in a way it is a, you know, it may have preceded the immigrants. And I wonder if with our advancement in genetics, why they, if they can do it with animals and other plants, why they can't tell what part or which plant is has which qualities, you know, whether it's an old fiber plant that's been here for hundreds of years, or whether it was a new, somebody brought it in. Another story I've also heard was that the due to the military presence in central Kansas, that the Afghani, I don't know what it was called, but the plant that was grown for its psychoactive properties, that that was the first place it came into the United States and spread around from there.
Well,
I don't know how true that is.
Yeah, let's let Mark Mayfield. Mark, I don't know if you're familiar with those anecdotal pieces of history or with some or with the science that Bill's asking about. Any response from you?
Well, I am not specifically familiar without a reference to with what he talked about in terms of the pollen record. I would not be the least bit surprised that for, say, the last 200 to 300 years you may have had the presence of hemp in the pollen record, which is studied intensively for reasons of climate change. We look at that pollen record for indications of changes in vegetation across the landscape. And so we might have started to register hemp at some point, but at least from the from everything I've read, hemp would not have appeared here until someone, say, post-European settlement, or at least Europeans arriving here. It wouldn't have been here prior to that, is what I'm trying to say. So back to the last ice age, I don't know of that documentation. I'd love to see it. However, he is right to say that it has been a part of the landscape for quite a long time, longer than our herbarium records would show, I'm sure, because people wouldn't start to collect it until it's actually fairly abundant, right?
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think its origin is definitely Central Asian. We sort of know that from what we have, but yes, it is fairly widespread here now.
Let's hear from Doc in Kansas. Hi, Doc.
Hello. Good show. I'm looking forward to getting Doug's book. You asked a question earlier about how did marijuana prohibition come to be, and I've read a good book called The Emperor Wears No Clothes, and they describe a situation, I think it was in the late 20s or the early 30s, where someone had invented a machine called the hydrodecorticator, where one person could strip industrial hemp in the field, and that you could make paper cheaper and with less waste and less use of water. And at that time, the family of William Randolph Hearst and all his cronies owned this all this forest land in California. So it was at that time that they created the DEA and created a bunch of hysteria and propaganda that included black men smoke this, rape white women, and got the public up in arms. And that's how all types of cannabis got lumped together. And it's just kind of a case of an oligarchy where economic influence affected policy that lasted for decades. And I'd like them to comment on that.
Yeah. Doug Fine, this sounds like a question for you.
So although a lot of what the caller says is probably true, exhaustive research over several years, there isn't a smoking gun. So if I could have time travel, I would travel into some late 1920s wood paneled club and inconspicuously sip my brandy and smoke the cigar and listen to Hearst and DuPont and the politicos of the day talking and plotting against cannabis. And it, you know, I wouldn't be at all surprised. What we do know is that reefer madness was a real phenomenon in the media and eventually in things like movies.
He mentions a racial component to that. Is that something you're familiar with?
Yeah, that definitely happened. And that, but what I'm getting at is that whether or not it was a conspiracy of oligarchs to stifle what we're discovering now. I mean, this is what's astonishing to me is non-political people, just researchers telling me this is, I can't believe we haven't been using this fiber. It's stronger than steel. It's lighter. It's easy to replicate. Well, biomaterials in general work better than synthetics is the bottom line, and cheaper without the dang petroleum and carbon, you know, output footprints issues, right? So why did we stop doing this? And it's an important question. But what we do know is absolutely Hearst newspapers ran yellow journalism with absurd, unbelievably racist motifs, and that Harry Anslinger, the first head of the Bureau of Narcotics, who, having failed at his effort at alcohol prohibition, now set out to find a new sort of thing to justify his budget. Yeah, no question about it. He would testify before Congress and say to the New York Times, we just have to stop the Negro jazz singer from going after our daughters. And so it really happened. The question is whether or not it was a result of economic conspiracy. The good news is, though, for those of us who realize, you know, I wave the red, white, and blue as a reason for why, you know, I'm really behind hemp's return. And I see on hemp lobbyists, I vote hemp.com, that in Missouri you have bills in your General Assembly, HB 2054 and HB 2338. It looks like they're in process now in your assembly, so you can get active on that.
Wait,
on
what are level, what wait, you just said a bunch of numbers, and a lot of our listeners might not know what you're referring to there.
Sure. So, okay, if you're fired up about hemp and want to see it back in Missouri soil and Kansas soil, for that matter, I should look up Kansas as well. But Missouri has two bills in your General Assembly now. And if folks want to know what they are and how to get active, they can go to votehemp.com. I'm not paid by those guys or anything. They're just a good resource and lobbyists for hemp, votehemp.com and look up Missouri or Kansas or your state. But also on the federal level, Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has introduced S-359, that's a number to remember, S-359, a Senate bill that would allow all of the U.S. do a little bit of a no-brainer. It would pull out hemp from the Controlled Substances Act and have it be regulated by the USDA like any other crop. Duh, it's just a crop. And Colorado's already doing this. I was in Colorado on the first day that their agriculture department started issuing applications and permits to Colorado farmers to cultivate unlimited amounts of hemp commercially. The Farm Bill only allows this research now, but S-359 would allow the whole country, all farmers, to start profiting the way that Canadian farmers are. And that's why Colorado is doing it, because the farmers are demanding the $300 an acre profits.
Interesting. Well, let's turn to Bob in Belton, who's called 816-235-2888. You can join our lineup of callers to get in on this conversation. Hi, Bob in Belton.
Hi there. I was curious why they got away from the hemp rope. When I was a kid, they had a factory up there at Walcott just by Parkville, and they made rope for the Second World War. And if you had hemp rope on the farm, you had good rope. You know, could depend on it. It was strong and good stuff. And I'd like to see that back.
What's your – tell us a little bit more about that background in Belton. How did you know about it? Were you a kid?
I just grew up around the area, and then I worked up in Parkville, and I got all these stories from the factory that was there just west of Parkville a little ways. I think the town was called Walcott. And then they had all this hemp growing out at Lexington, great big – farm out there. You still see the remnants of the post with their name on it. Ryan, I think, was the name of the people, and they were raising it. And of course, that Civil War era. They had these guys fighting out there by Lexington. They're rolling these big bales of hemp up the hill for protection so they could fire on the other guys. It's interesting.
Well, thanks, Bob. Is the history that he is talking about something you're familiar with, Mark Mayfield, or Doug Fine, either of you?
Well, I'd like to jump in and just, it's not. I do know that hemp was much more prevalent at one time. Doug will be able to certainly develop that a lot more than me, but I was going to throw in a little piece of trivia that I didn't hear Doug say that I'm sure he's familiar with, and that is that the very first set of Levi's jeans were made from hemp cloth, and I'll leave it at that and let Doug take from there.
Yeah, the Japanese emperor attends coronation in a hemp robe. There is quite a long history with it. And so that was a great, oh gosh, that is the kind of story from that last caller that I love to hear, because it's like pushpins on a map of where hemp was big. Like I recently found out Lancaster, Pennsylvania, just huge. It was a hemp economy in the 19th century. That's what they did there. And Toledo, Ohio still has the institutional memory of being the shipping port when all this heartland hemp was needed to get out through the Great Lakes shipping lanes. And they're excited for that revival. They're very excited and aware of the fact that, for instance, Kentucky seeds are going in this year, hopefully Kansas, Missouri next year. But Indiana's got their hemp legislation going.
Quickly with stories like Bob's, how do you confirm whether what you're hearing is, I mean, I guess not an urban legend, like maybe more of a rural legend. How do you confirm that that's history and not anecdote?
Well, any of them that I want to then, you know, document, I do my research on, and it's really often not very difficult to do. There's one that I love that I cannot find anywhere, if anyone can find it, which is that that hempcrete was basically known, and that it was late 19th century, 1880s or 90s, Chicago World Fair, that was like a world exposition that was like a big deal, kind of started the World Fair phenomenon in the States, and huge expositions with wonders that blew people's minds for decades, right? That their main hall was built with hemp-based construction material. That's one that I have not been able to document, but you know, go into the history of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and you know it's there. It's there. Lexington Journal just did a story about Kentucky's first millionaire in the 1820s from hemp. So there's no question about that, about the industry. The real thing is now, how can we make use of hemp's applications? And it's really there in the marketplace on the seed oil. This energy application that I keep alluding to, it's the real deal also. It's a process called gasification, and it's going on in Europe right now. It's a relatively carbon-friendly biomass combustion that communities in Germany and Austria especially are becoming completely energy independent by simply using their otherwise wasted farm materials that's not part of their marketable farm products, not necessarily hemp.
All right. Well, I hate to interrupt, but we do have some more callers with some local stories. So let's get to those. If you're just tuning in, you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR 89.3 FM, streaming live at kcur.org. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Doug Fine and Mark Mayfield about hemp. Let's turn to Nathan in Topeka. Hi, Nathan.
Good morning. I just had a comment here, I guess. Way back in high school, you know, in my journeys driving around, we found that there was always hemp growing all along the railroad tracks, and I'd heard that it was just from the trains that were passing through and all the seeds would fall off. And if that was like, you know, I don't know, there's some legal issues in testing those sort of things these days, but that sounds like it would be a useful cultivar if it came from, the hemp industry.
Mark Mayfield, what do you know about that?
Yeah, so I can't really speculate on why hemp is along railroad tracks. I would say that his explanation that it was on the trains and it fell off is probably a good one, because we do know that happened with a lot of weeds that got distributed around the country. I do a lot of weed stuff, so I happen to know that there's a pattern where where there's a railroad, you can look for new weeds. But on the whether or not you would want to look to those sites, for new or good genetic material, very possibly. I know that nowadays, clearly we're not distributing hemp on railroads now, but those places are still prevalent, places where the plant is prevalent, as well as on weedy, uncultivated borders of fields and stuff. So it may just be happen chance that those are good places to look.
As long as we're talking about this plant growing out in Kansas, how hospitable is Kansas soil to the plant?
Well, to the wild plant, the one that's naturalized here.
Yeah. Do you foresee Kansas soil, if it were to become legal, being good for cultivating hemp?
Well, I would think so. The way this stuff grows, I see it. Now, it grows best down near river bottom areas where the soil is deep and relatively fertile. So, but along there's a certain bike path around here that the plants are well over the height of my head when I go down those trails. I mean, probably twice as tall as I am, so 12, 15 feet tall sometimes. So I would guess quite good, but I'm not an expert in that realm. So,
Doug Fine, do you know the answer to that one? All right, let's go to John in Turner. Hi, John.
Hello, good morning.
Hello.
Yes, I want to mention another further racial angle. The Mexican workers were coming out to work on the railroads primarily, and they might have brought some marijuana with them, and so it was stigmatized that way, too. You guys might want to take and run with that, and I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
All right, thanks, John. So John's referring back to a caller earlier who said that it could be that part of the stigmatization of this crop has racial angle to it originally, and he's adding that locally that maybe some of the Mexican workers along the railroads were also implicated in that. Doug Fine, any input?
Yeah, I don't know about that specific thread, and there was no question there were racial overtones. In fact, the model for the National Narcotics Board effort when cannabis prohibition started in the late 30s was my region here in the Southwest. It was first used, Arizona, New Mexico, and California, in battles between Latino and Anglo power structures for political control of the region. And the first image was of the brown-skinned, swarthy person coming in and trying to seduce rancher daughters and stuff like that. So there definitely is a long history of that. And as for appropriate climate for hemp cultivation, hemp is cultivated in every part of the world except for Antarctica. So there are cultivars that are adapted to every ecosystem at this point. But where I think the seed development needs to happen is in this issue of dual cropping, where American farmers can cultivate for both seed and fiber applications from a single harvest. So we definitely have some work to do there. As far as falling off the trains and those being good cultivars to study, no question about it. A Nebraska rancher told me that her daddy used to cultivate hemp along the irrigation ditches because no matter how wet it got, hemp has a really unusual quality. Again, it's not magical. We bred it. Foot-long tap roots that really provide great erosion control. So map this on not only the struggling heartland today, but sub-Saharan Africa, an annual that really holds strong roots. And after the watering season, they'd feed the cattle on the hemp, by the way.
Doug, before we reach the end of this hour, I want to ask you, you've mentioned that you've done extensive research over the past several years on this subject, and I wonder if you can describe for us what that research has involved, because you really do seem to have a little bit of contact, with a lot of different people involved in this story.
Oh, yeah, I only write about things that I care about and seem important to me, and this one kind of got very personal as a parent, really, because of the potential of climate change mitigation. If we switch from amber waves of GMO corn to green waves of industrial cannabis, we're going to be changing our food and our energy system. But to give you specifics, I met with this terrific family of farmers in heartland of Canada that are part of this big hemp industry explosion, Grant and Colleen Dick, very religious Christian, you know, they were the typical, they seemed like typical American heartland farmers, only they were north of the border. And busy people working hard, cultivating hemp and doing it because they believe in it for nutritive and spiritual reasons, but also very candidly describing to me growing pains about learning how to, you know, it may grow like a weed, folks, but if you want to be a professional farmer and harvest hemp, you have to know what you are doing.
Well, are you at all concerned about hemp becoming another monoculture crop like corn? Because, you know, you just mentioned amber waves of grain to green waves of hemp.
Great question, Gina. And so Canada in 1998 did a very important thing prophylactically. The moment that they started their hemp industry, they banned genetically modified hemp. It didn't exist then, and it doesn't exist now. I would love, in fact, when I'm in D.C., you know, speaking about hemp, I lobby the hemp lobbyists to try to get something like that in our legislation. And most of the reason for that is something we discussed earlier. It's off-brand. But in truth, hemp, the Canadian government, in their advice to farmers, they have an Excel sheet that says no herbicides and pesticides needed.
Okay.
We don't need genetically modified.
I hate to cut you off, but we're really running out of time. So I've got to thank our guests, Doug Fine, author of Hemp Bound, and Mark Mayfield, research assistant professor in the Division of Biology at Kansas State University. Thanks so much. To listen back to today's show or any previous conversations on Central Standard, go to kcur.org/Central Standard. You can also stay current on Central Standard News by following us on Twitter. Our handle is @KCURCST. Our show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton and Sylvia Maria Gross. Join us tomorrow as we get a better understanding of the Common Core and have a conversation with a local crime novelist. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned for Up to Date next.